The Battle of Hastings, October 14th, 1066. Tremendous outcome. This battle will change England for century after century after century. It's also the only time England has been successfully invaded from the outside with an army. The Battle of Hastings pits, of course, William the Conqueror with his claim to the throne that I've gone through in several previous podcasts against the last of the other claimants. You have King of England, Anglo-Saxon, King of England, Harold Godwin, or Godwinson as some people call him. He has successfully defeated the two other claimants, which was his brother, Tostig, and King of the Danes, Harald Hardrada. They were defeated and killed at the Battle of Stamford Bridge on September the 25th in 1066. Unfortunately for Harold, William's forces have now landed after coming across the English Channel, probably on the 27th and the 28th of September, and then landing on the southern coast. He now has again faced another army, and in many ways a much more formidable army. Now, the Normans are former Vikings who settled in northern France under the leadership of Rollo, and were several generations removed from them. And they have some of the tactics that you would find the Vikings using. However, they're very heavy in the cavalry. They're armored cavalry with the teardrop-shaped shields and a variety of other things really make them the significant style of warrior at this particular time in European history. So Harold's first attempt is he's got to move south. I mean, he marched his army north from London as it was just a couple of weeks before, well, actually a few days before. Now he's got to move south again. He's going to march his army in a four-day period of time 200 miles, which in many ways is actually faster than the rate that he moved from London to the Stamford Bridge. So eventually, on October the 14th, the two sides meet at Hastings on Senlac Hill. And this has everything on the line. This isn't like just a battle where the loser will then retreat and fight again. You have the Anglo-Saxon noblemen of England who are supporting Harold, their king. Even though that William had legal claim to the throne, they selected Harold. So in many ways, what's going to happen is, should Harold become defeated and the Normans win, which of course we know they will, all of those lords who backed Harold are going to forfeit their land. So you're going to have the redistribution of all of the major pieces of property in England under William that will eventually lead to a near-perfect feudal society. But wait, let's get back to the battle. From the English side, we have Harold with between 1,300 and 1,400 housecarls. Now, those are his personal bodyguards, his best troops. They have about 7,000 other infantry, and they're sitting on top of a hill behind what we would refer to as a shield wall, which is a standard tactic used at this particular time. The Vikings use it. A lot of people use it. You overlap your three and a half foot diameter shields, making it very difficult for an opponent to get something to hit. And if you can stay put and don't break that shield wall, it works pretty well. I mean, a lot of times the Anglo-Saxons will use a similar weapon. They'll use axes, and sometimes they'll use that long-handled Viking axe, which is great because you can literally, if you look at a true Viking axe in a museum, the front of the axe blade has a little tip and indentation. If you swing that at somebody and swing it long, in other words, instead of hitting the person, the blade falls behind them, and they get, you hit your opponent on the shoulders with the handle. you go, oh, I'm okay. But no, what happens? You hit the person on the shoulder with your handles, and then you pull the axe towards you, and that blade will then catch and stab you in the back and then pull you forward so you can bash them in the head. The only problem with the shield wall is discipline. Unfortunately, the Anglo-Saxons have a tendency to do very similar things like the Vikings, and they will break the shield wall to chase somebody. The Normans, on the other hand, are counting on their heavy cavalry, the 2,000 to 3,000 mounted cavalry. Those guys are covered in chainmail from head to foot. They will probably have that over a leather shirt underneath and some other padded material to kind of help on arrow shots. They carry a teardrop-shaped shield, which on horseback means that there's not much to hit either. From a side point of view, it covers the upper part of the body and then narrows down as you just have the leg. Normans will also have about 1,000 archers and about 6,000 other assorted infantry. Now, these numbers are the best guesstimates that we have based on people who received land from the Domesday Book and other accounts. There could be the English could have as many as 10,000. The Normans probably aren't going to be much smaller than the number that I'm quoted here. So one could say that they're relatively even. The difference is in cavalry, where the Anglo-Saxons really don't have any. There's always been a lot of discussion about where were the Anglo-Saxon horsemen. Now, horses are very expensive to keep up. And it just wasn't customary for them to have horses. The Normans used horses because that was the response of the French and other continental countries to Viking invasions, to put mounted troops for quick response. The Normans just simply adopted that and brought them over, and they realized that a man on horse in full armor against a man on foot is a mismatch. So the English have taken up perfectly good defensive positions at the top of Senlac Hill, which of course will mean that the Normans will have to come to them. And being on top of the hill, that gives them longer range. They want to throw their spears. They do have some bowmen. That will give them a little greater distance. It also means that should they choose to attack, they have the momentum of going downhill. On the opposite side, the Normans will simply have to march uphill to fight. That's going to be harder. It's going to cause them, you know, to use up a little bit more energy. They also have to be careful in retreating so that they don't break formation and leave themselves open to an attack from the English. The horses will also get tired. Of course, sitting on a hill, it's going to possibly cut down your distance. A little harder to hit your targets with the arrows. There are a variety of things. The general intent of the Normans was to attack and then pretend like they were retreating, hoping that the English would then break formation, chase them, and then their mounted cavalry could come in and finish them off. Most of the schematic drawings that have been done in military institutes such as West Point and that you'll find in Osprey Men-at-Arms books show infantry and the Normans in front and the cavalry then back behind them, so that they can exploit any breaks that the infantry are able to get. Well, the battle goes back and forth. Some of the men do fall for that and they slaughter, but not very many in large numbers. One of the key points early on in favor of the English is that during the combat, William lost his helmet. Now, the soldiers need to see where their leader is, and frequently you'll have a flag bearer with them or some insignia, and in William's case it's his helmet, which had evidently some insignia on top of it, and it's not exactly a difficult person to see. He's, you know, I think he's 6'6 in height. He's a pretty good sized fellow. But at any rate, the soldiers for a while couldn't find him. Now, this would mean that maybe he was killed or badly injured. Well, this causes the morale to kind of falter. at some point. And if you look at the Bayeux Tapestry, and the Bayeux Tapestry is actually our one of our best sources. It was done probably, commissioned probably by one of William's friends, Bishop Lanfranc. And it actually goes from the point in which Edward the Confessor pledges the throne all the way to William taking the throne. And it goes through most of the battle. It's fun if you can get. They used to have computer versions of it online, which you could look at the weave and all the other stuff in it, which is fascinating. And now I believe you, in order to see that, you have to pay for it. Seeing it in person is a little problematic. I mean, it's almost 1,000 years old, so it's in special lighting, and you know you don't want to hog looking at one particular section. I think one of the best items sold, and you don't have to go to Bayeux to get this. There are a lot of places that sell this. I think the British Museum sells it. And I got mine at Bayeux, but they sell a miniaturized folding version so that you can stretch the whole thing out and go frame by frame by frame and look at it. But there's odd stuff in there, too. There's a little pillaging on there. There's a little stripping of armor. There's a little... let's just leave it at some odd things if you look at the margins around it. But anyway, what happens is Count Eustace, and if you remember from previous podcasts, Count Eustace was one of the Norman commanders under Edward the Confessor, who got into a little trouble with the Godwin family. He is riding around with William in the little sequence on the Bayeux Tapestry, pointing to William. And what William does is he rides back and forth across the battlefield, showing himself to everybody, so that it restores the morale of the troops. My wife always gives me a hard time at this point because she's descended from the Putnam families, which is a direct descendant of Count Eustace. So her family is actually depicted on horseback in the Bayeux Tapestry. Now, my family was also involved because we're listed on the Domesday Book as receiving land from William as well, but we're probably, knowing my luck, it's probably the guy stripping the armor off the losers. But it's funny that the two of us would have relatives in the same region, but hers is all fancy and on horseback. So that stabilized the Norman position. And then they continue bouncing and battling back and forth. And then later on in the day, William orders his archers to instead of shooting up, to fire high and let them drop down. And, you know, chance shot. Harold takes a shot in the eye. I mean, an arrow, I don't know whether he's looking up or, you know, it's coming in and it nails him right in the eye and probably killed him instantly. Well, this has a pretty deflating effect on the Anglo-Saxons. I mean, as well-trained as the Normans were, you could see how their morale faltered when they thought William was dead. Well, now you actually have a dead king on your hands. And at this point, the Normans saw an opportunity and charged forward, broke the shield wall, and then began slaughtering. The story goes that they cut poor Harold into so many pieces that after the battle, nobody could recognize him. Nobody could find him. There's an old story that one of his mistresses, I think her name was Edith Swansneck, went out to the battlefield a couple of days later with a couple of his aides, and they were able to recognize enough parts of him to give him a burial. But the English are successful. The area has, they built a monastery up on the line. The Bayeux Tapestry shows Harold getting hit in the eye. And as a matter of fact, directly underneath him on the border, there's someone stripping a soldier of his armor. And that is it. That is the catastrophe, the end of the Anglo-Saxon leadership of England, and now it will become Normans for a while. William will then move into London and be crowned on December the 25th, Christmas Day. Now, if you go to Hastings, there's Battle Abbey. You can actually go onto some of the sites. A part of the battlefield at one point actually came up for, I believe it's the 1960s, came up for sale. And a conglomerate of American universities purchased it and then donated it back to the British to be kept as a battlefield, and so they wouldn't build, you know, a mall on it or something. Like, you can understand that the English really wouldn't care that much about it, since it was a losing battle. But that is going to have incredible ramifications for England from here on in, good and bad. A lot of times there isn't much discussion on what happens after Hastings, and that's one of the things that I will do in a podcast here in another week or so, as I want to talk about the reorganization of England, the pacification, and the problems that William has in the northern part, where a large amount of the population ends up revolting and getting butchered. Now, tons of books on Hastings. Hastings 1066 by Gravett. That is an Osprey Men-at-Arms campaign series, I believe. The Bayeux Tapestry, anything on the Bayeux Tapestry is excellent. And if you've never seen it, hunt it up. The Feudal Kingdom of England, 1042 to 1216 by Barlow. Hope you enjoyed that. Don't forget to come by summahistorica.com. Pick up a CD. Leave some comments. Ask a question. Thank you very much for everything. I hope you enjoyed that.